I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Can you give us a question, sir? Can you state categorically that nobody, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
That's right, on this edition of Parallax Views, we are delving into the phenomena of fake news with Nolan Higdon, an associate of the Project Censored Media Watchdog organization and author of The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. What does fake news mean? Beyond the accusations back and forth between the partisan parties that the other is the real fake news, the real propaganda, if you will. Hopefully, Nolan will help us answer that question in the following conversation, as well as explaining why a free press, a fourth estate, that acts first and foremost not in the service of profit, but rather to inform the public, is necessary to a healthy, functioning democracy. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. Welcome to Parallax Views, Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. Nolan, I have to say I've been wanting to get you on the program for a while because you're a sort of fellow traveler at Project Censored, which I'm a big fan of. I've had Mickey on a number of times now.
Well, it's great to be on. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Nolan, if you could, maybe you could give a little bit of background on yourself, your association with Project Censored, for people that may be unfamiliar with you.
Yeah, I started out as a student with Project Censored back in 2002, 2003. So I've been associated with them almost going on 15, 20 years now. It was working with a project that kind of actually piqued my interest in news media and propaganda. And as I continued to go through school, I've published a lot on media literacy and news abuse and things like that. And I contributed to the Censored book every year for a number of years. Most recently, I worked with a project. Me and my students made a documentary called United States of Distraction, which is about fake news, which is online for free on YouTube. So I've done a lot of the publication work, did a lot of work with students, and I'm also a lecturer, university lecturer in media studies and history as well.
So this title, The Anatomy of Fake News, I think there's going to be people that listen to that title and they'll say, oh, is he like using fake news in the Trump way or the way that liberal Democrats use it? And I feel like you're not using it either way necessarily.
Yeah. You know, funny you should mention that. That was one of, I guess my own naivete. That was something I didn't see happening that ended up bogging me down in a lot of the writing process, which is that, when Trump started weaponizing the phrase to denounce any reporting he found inconvenient, I saw that as a problem. What I didn't anticipate was a lot of my colleagues just sort of abdicated the phrase now. So fake news is like Trump's phrase, and if you use it, you're a Trump supporter, is how a lot of people have come to see it.
It didn't really originally come from Trump, though.
Right. Yeah. In 2016, it was really Hillary Clinton who popularized it. But even prior to that, it goes back to the 19th century. So, in a lot of articles I've submitted, you know, I've gotten feedback from scholars who say, like, hey, if you're going to use this fake news epithet, you're supporting Trump. And I completely disagree. I think, you know, fake news is any false or misleading information that's introduced as legitimate journalism. And I think it's important that we sort of de-Trump the topic. Trump is a symptom of this larger topic, but he's hardly the focal point when we're talking about fake news.
When did the term first start gaining steam? I know it was in 2016. We mentioned Hillary used it, but I think Trump used it like 400 times in one year at one point.
Yeah. There was all these sort of baseless conspiracies going around the internet in 2016, as there always is on the internet. And Hillary Clinton sort of on the campaign trail kept calling this stuff fake news and saying that it was responsible for the type of reporting she was receiving and all this stuff. Trump, you know, kind of brilliantly saw the power of that phrase and weaponized it for his own means. And yeah, he was using it consistently, and eventually it just sort of took on a life of its own. It became like a pop culture phenomenon with like TV shows being based off it and things like that. And it got so popular that Trump doesn't even really need to say why he's saying something is fake news. He can just say it's fake news. And those who support him or ascribe to his presidency, they seem to know what he's talking about. So in that way, it's a very powerful tool for Trump.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the pop culture thing. I did not know until reading your book that there's been whole shows based around this. There's apparently the Fake News Hour on Comedy Central. There's the Fake News Show, which is a game show where they have to figure out what the fake news is and what's the real news. And the Murphy Brown reboot dealt with it in the first episode. I'm like, whoa, this is much bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah, it came, just became like, yeah, a cultural phenomenon, which, you know, going back to where you started this interview, when people started talking about fake news and it became a cultural phenomenon, I was personally excited. I was like, all right, finally we can talk about the false reporting that goes on in this country from a litany of actors, and maybe we can address how it's a threat to democracy. But God, did that conversation not quickly devolve into Democrats accusing Republicans of fake news and Republicans accusing Democrats of fake news, and any sort of substantive discourse was tramped out in these partisan bickering matches.
What do you think about how the sort of fake news discourse arose after the Trump election? And then I want to get into a deeper analysis of what we mean by fake news, but I'm specifically referring to things like PropOrNot, which we're pointing out, oh, these are fake news websites, but they included a lot of websites like Counterpunch or Black Agenda Report that, I don't know, it seems like there was a bias sort of going after progressive websites.
Yeah, I would agree. And just to be transparent, I've written for Counterpunch, so I take that personally for a number of reasons. That was, PropOrNot and similar lists that were going around were a reason why I wrote the book. I was seeing that the way people were dealing with the real problem of fake news was by creating these artificial lists of this is good news outlets, these are bad news outlets. And what I try to show in the book is like, look, even the most reputable news sources get things wrong. They themselves produce fake news. I mean, you know, the New York Times, that's who employed Judith Miller, who ran the WMD story that led us into Iraq. They're also the ones who hired Jason Blair, who wrote 2200 false stories. So
the one I always think of, not to interrupt you, but I always mention the baby incubator story from the first Gulf War.
Yeah. The Saudi princess. Yeah. Right. So those are, you know, fake news stories that have had real world impacts where you've had, you know, millions of people get killed, and they came from, you know, these news outlets that would be on this list as being legitimate journalists. And I just think lists are not the way to go about solving this problem. So I was, yeah, not a fan of Propernot or those types of things. But there is a historical analogy here that also scares me, and I think you point this out with Propernot, is traditionally fear of the other, whether it be communism or most recently Russia, is it always begins as a critique of conservatives or something like that, but it always ends up getting turned against the progressive left. So I saw these supposed liberals, you know, rally around the "Let's Get the Russians" flag for 2-3 years. And then all of a sudden it was pointed at them, progressives, right? You must be in Putin's pockets. And there was these false news stories around like the Bernie Sanders campaign and things like that. So it's just not healthy for a democracy to kind of have these lists and these baseless accusations. So we really need a populace that's able to critically think and analyze content for themselves rather than depend on these shadowy organizations like Propernot.
In regards to fake news itself, what does fake news mean? Because I feel like it has different meanings to different people. We alluded to that. You know, I think when liberals say fake news, it means something very different than a supporter of Donald Trump. So what do you mean by fake news, and how can we sort of understand the concept better?
Yeah, the way I went to define fake news is I went a step backward. I went to what is news. And so my first chapter in the book, I give a kind of brief summation of news. And one of the things I wanted to illustrate in there is that we think of news as being done by professionals, but news is you know, old as the hills. Oral news is news. And so I argue in the book that anything that is false or misleading information that is introduced as legitimate journalism or news is fake news. And that gives us kind of a much more broad area of information to look at. That means we can't narrow the conversation to just the Russians or Facebook or Republicans. It means we have to take a much more broader look at our information sphere. And that's why I kind of wrote the book from a historical point of view to say, I'm not trying to get into the partisan weeds here and take a quote unquote side. I'm trying to show this giant media ecosystem that is filled with fake news. And once we understand what fake news is and how pervasive it is, then I think we can start to address it.
In that regard, what's some historical examples we have of fake news before the digital age? I like some of the examples you bring up, which is why I ask specifically.
Feel free to chime in and ask about any of them. But I think one of my favorites, I know it's a little outdated, but I really like the penny press. I thought that was a kind of funny example from the 19th century that it cost newspapers in the 19th century about 6 cents to write, print, and take home a small profit off of newspapers. Well, the penny press emerged. They would do it for a penny. They would replace the lost revenue with advertising. And instead of doing journalism, they would just make up stories. And so they made up things like the Great Moon Hoax, like you could see like this moon colony and they had the Batman and all this, half man, half bat, all those kind of stories emerged from the penny press. But in some way, it's an analogy of what happened with news later on, right? Is that the 24-hour news networks sort of did the same thing in the sense that they did less and less reporting, depended more and more on advertisers, and filled the time with basically trivial conversations, you know, sort of partisan debates and things like that. So I'm always a big fan of that example from the 19th century. I would be remiss if I didn't mention one of my favorite fake newsers of all time, which is William Miller, who promised that he brought the news about how the world was going to end 4 times, and he got hundreds of thousands of people to turn out and see the end of the world and things like that. So I go through a lot of those historical examples, but I mix them with the present day examples. Some of the big ones like the CIA overseas, you know, using fake news to get people to turn on leaders like Guatemala and Iran. Our CIA false stories that ended up coming to the United States press as well, which Bernstein exposed in the 1970s.
Operation Mockingbird, right?
Correct. Yeah. So I go through all those, and then, you know, I go up all the way to the present. I talk about deep fakes and the digital age and all that stuff and try and, you know, connect it together again to show that this isn't new, nor is it going to end just because we want it to. We're going to have to actually make some effort to address the issue.
The one that stood out to me was, because I never thought of it the way you did, and I probably should have, because it's so blindingly obvious, is you're like one of the earliest examples is Christopher Columbus. How is Christopher Columbus connected to fake news?
Yeah, he falsely reported where he was and falsely reported what he found. And his fake news about the Americas and the gold that was everywhere and all these things, this ended up serving as the basis for which people came to the New World. They came to the New World for conquest and profits. It wasn't for vacation. It wasn't to understand people. It wasn't to settle and, you know, with folks. So his fake news really set the tone for which type of people came here and what their expectations were when they arrived. I started the Columbus is one of the earliest examples in the Americas that I could find.
And it's interesting because I feel like a lot of people sort of ignore that history. They act as if, you know, this whole fake news thing is a completely new phenomena when really it's sort of always been with us, even going back to the days of William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah, for the yellow press and things like that, which were trying to goad us into war. This is American democracy. We tout it as the way that elections are decided are who has the better ideas. But in practice, it's generally trying to motivate the population with whatever information you can find, whether it's true or false. And so fake news has had a long history of trying to move the electorate in one direction or another. There is a long history, you bring up Hearst, there's a long history of war being fostered through fake news. So fake news generally gets the population to go to war. You brought up the babies in incubators that was used on the eve of the first Gulf War. You could talk about the WMDs in the second one. You could talk about the Phantom Gulf of Tonkin attack for Vietnam, on and on and on. And so that's why, again, it's so important. If you care about democracy, you have to care about fake news in the sense that if people are believing false things and using them as a way to decide whether they vote or how they vote or what they support or don't support, that's you don't have a democracy. You just kind of have the facade of one.
You know, it's interesting. I was a media communications student when I went for my undergrad. I just graduated about a year ago. And, congrats. You know, my teacher would make us read Bill Moyers, right? Because he's written a few books on democracy and the free press. But it's odd because I feel like if you're not taking a media communications course or you're not studying in that area within academia, we don't really talk about the connection between democracy and the press or even this idea of the fourth estate. Maybe you could comment on that and sort of describe what we mean by the fourth estate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct as well. We don't teach journalism or news because we see that as being like for journalism or communication students. But our democracy in the United States is predicated on a free press. I mean, it's in the First Amendment. And there's been efforts to try and undermine it as well as strengthen it throughout our entire history. The idea of the fourth estate is basically that you need some independent pillar of information that holds the powerful accountable, informs the general population in order for democracy to survive. And the press was supposed to be that. That's why they get such a long leash to say and do the things that they want to do. What I point out in the book, one of the areas I think that Americans really missed one of the glaring errors in our free press system that Americans have long missed is that the founding fathers sort of believed that if you had a free and vibrant press, truth would be out there and truth would always outcompete falsehoods. So as long as we kept a media ecosystem where truth could exist, we'd be good. And what I kind of argue in the book is that you still need that diverse media system. You still need truth out there. But if you don't have a population that can delineate truth from falsehood, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the truth is out there. That's why some people say like we're post-truth. No, we're not. Some people have decided not to recognize truth, but we're not post-truth. Truth still is out there. It still exists. We can still access it if we know how. So I think that the free press remains important. I would like to see in the United States, it'd be more diversified. We have six corporations controlling 90% of our media. Furthermore, a lot of what people claim is news is not news, like social media posts and things like that. So I like to see a lot more diversity of news, but the importance of the press has not changed. But what you do see, and this I think is a connection, that there's been a big fear in the last five or so years that democracy is under threat around the world. Well, I think it's no coincidence. You also see freedom of press is under threat around the world. And in countries like the United States, the press has like an all-time low approval rating. So for folks like myself, and I'm sure for you coming out of a communications program, we're in kind of a tough spot because we can't deny the glaring problems with our press, but sometimes it's tough to defend some members of our press, like the corporate outlets and things like that, because they perpetuate the problem rather than seek to solve it.
I wanted to comment on that really briefly. I recently had Noam Chomsky on the program, and I asked him about, you know, right when Trump won the election, there were a lot of op-eds coming out in places like The Atlantic, I think even The New York Times, The Washington Post, saying we have too much democracy and democracy will fail because we have too much of it. There's too much of this populism and, you know, people have too much choice and this is how we got Trump. And I was like really horrified that anyone in, you know, the press would say that, because I think we need more democracy, not less of it. And it sort of, I think, brings me into conflict with certain media figures, because I look at certain media figures and I'm like, wow, they have a really elitist attitude and sort of a sort of disdain for certain democratic processes. See, but now I feel like when I say that, I'm sounding like a Trump supporter, because Trump always talks about the elites. It's complicated, though.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. It is complicated. But I would, you know, I would sort of say this about we're a nation of 330 million people. And so I try and stay away from treating the quote-unquote Trump supporter as a monolith. You know, people vote for the strangest of reasons, right? Like, we all have our own unique reasons why we do what we do, who we vote for, or if we don't vote, right? You know, they always say people are lazy who don't vote. Some people don't vote because they don't like the choices, or some people don't vote because it rained that day. I mean, you know, there's so many things. And that's my long way of saying that, you know, the populist attention around Trump, I'm sort of less concerned with criticizing Trump and more interested in why a substantial portion of the population would gravitate towards someone like Trump rather than the other options. And I think that was kind of the big democratic story, democratic in terms of system story, that was missed after 2016. Like, what is it about the Democratic Party? What is it about Hillary Clinton? What is it about the policies they do or don't advocate for, where some people would take a shot on a reality television star who with no governing experience? I mean, I think that's really the bigger story there. I know they tried to fill that gap in with like Russiagate and all these other stories, but I think there's kind of some crucial questions about why people would do that. And you know, they try to treat those folks as a monolith, right? They're either all racist or all sexist or all xenophobic. And there's definitely tons of that going around in those Trump rallies. I mean, you'd have to be asleep not to see it. But there was also, you know, a substantial number of voters. Some people have it as low as 6 million, some as high as 9 million, that voted for Obama and then switched over to Trump. And so even though they may have more racist attitudes, they were still willing to vote for the first self-identified African-American president, but then switch to Trump. So what is it? What is it about the system? I think those are the kind of questions that are more fruitful to be asking rather than kind of labeling people or trying to take away democracy. I don't think that's productive in any sense of the word.
An example I was going to give too was the whole Brexit deal in Britain, because I was talking to someone about this yesterday. I think media outlets in Britain probably have a degree of responsibility in the Brexit vote happening, in so much as people weren't informed properly about what Brexit would entail. And I guess that leads me to the question of what role does the media play in some of the problems that have arisen today? I mean, if we're afraid of things like the rise of Trumpism, the sort of Brexit right wing in Britain, what role does the media play in sort of building these things up unintentionally or otherwise?
In the United States, we've come down to our news media system treats everything like a World Wrestling Entertainment match. And I know Matt Taibbi's written about this, but previous to Matt Taibbi, Eric Bischoff, who used to work for World Championship Wrestling.
I'm a big wrestling fan, so I know exactly who you're talking about.
Oh, dude, then I'm in good company. All right, awesome. So he gave a TED Talk, and he said this years ago. He said, like, oh, I watched the news. I know what they're doing. They're doing faces and heels, good guys versus bad guys, on the news networks, because we know as wrestling writers that that's how you keep audiences. So news is doing the same thing. Well, that might work, like, if it's a personality issue, right? Would you rather, like, have a cup of coffee with Trump or Hillary? I mean, maybe that would be helpful in that context. But when it comes down to, like, what should, like, our global climate change policy be, we need to talk about the actual kind of, like, wonky policy issues. Or what are the implications of Brexit? Like, those are wonky issues that need to be talked about. And the press in the United States really does a horrible job about talking about those things. And the press in the U.S. is always hid behind the idea. They say, well, the average American isn't that smart. They can't pay attention that long, so we don't go for those wonky stories. And that gets back to that kind of elitist narrative you were talking about before. I look at, like, podcasts, for example. People will tune in to listen to a podcaster talk to one person on maybe one issue for, like, 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and the American public is engaged with it. So I think that the press, they've always used these excuses to justify their economic model. But the long-term impact is that they really stupefy a lot of, like, really important issues. I mean, we were the only country basically left in the world that had a major party that denied climate change for the longest amount of time. While other countries were debating how to address it, we were still debating whether or not it existed for decades. Now, that's an example of a sort of press failure. It wasn't like the scientific community was divided. You know, this was clear. The conclusion had been drawn and proven over and over again. So I think that's kind of where the press fails, is they break everything down into a partisan issue. And one of the things I tried to point out in the book is that there is no real hero party when it comes to a lot of these issues or fake news practices. These are supposed to be vehicles to get policy achieved. They're not supposed to be, like, brands that you identify with or things like that. And so I think one of the things I try and push for in the book, and I think this is sound advice I would give to everyone, is try and rise above, like, the hating the other party and loving your party unconditionally. Try and be, you know, a free thinker, an independent thinker, and draw a conclusion based on evidence, not on which party you want to win or lose.
In that regard, I wanted to add to, what do you think the profit motive is? Because, I mean, we're talking about corporate media in a lot of ways. And I always tell people, you know, Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson, these weren't the first guys to do what they did. I mean, you can go back to the 1980s with, like, Morton Downey Jr. and then Jerry Springer. And, you know, even I was watching a documentary recently on the Buckley-Vidal debates from 68. Wow. And I was like, oh, this is sort of where this combat TV model comes from. What role does the media being corporate and sort of wanting to push sort of combat and sensational, you know, attention-grabbing material, what role does that play in harming our media ecosystem?
Yeah, good question. I think it does severe damage because, and I've started to do a lot more of this in my op-eds, actually, for Counterpunch and Truthout. And Matt Taibbi's written about this as well. Most of the people in the press aren't experts. They don't know what they're talking about, but they introduce themselves as experts. Like, they talk with authority on issues of, like, the economy, for example. I mean, everyone famously remembers Jim Cramer talking about how the economy was going to keep growing as it's crashing before his eyes in 2008, for example.
Can I comment on that? I've watched a few Cramer clips recently, and I just thought to myself, wow, he's like I think he's on CNBC. And I was like, my God, he's like the Alex Jones of CNBC just in his mannerisms and how he talks. I'm like, whoa. Go on. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No worries. I completely agree. But yeah, he, you know, he, So that's an economic failure, but they make up things. Like, my favorite is like electability. Like, what does that mean? Like, there's no data to back that up. It's a trope that they just kind of pull out about who is electable and who's not, to swing the electorate toward one candidate or another. Remember, Hillary Clinton was supposedly the most electable. How'd that turn out? So those kinds of things I think are the ways in which they hurt the public. Because they introduce themselves as experts and they're not. Another way they hurt the public, though, is we've increasingly gone off the deep end with thinking we can't talk to people who we disagree with. And this has sort of two scary outcomes. One is that we just think if you support anything that Trump supports, even tangentially, okay, you're anathema to our society. You can't be a Democrat. You can't be a liberal. And the same thing if you're a Trump supporter. You say something nice about like Hillary Clinton, oh, you know, off with your head. You got to be gone out of the Republican Party. So there's that. And what it does is it creates kind of like a calcified position. Everyone has puts pressure on other folks. You have to be like 100% lock, stock, and barrel with them. There can be no divergent views. In that sense, and that's really scary for democracy. We should be able to disagree. We have to be able to communicate and talk with one another. But if you turn on news media, we can't. All we do is yell over each other. We scream at each other. These are irreconcilable differences. Back to the pro wrestling analogy, right? Pro wrestling goes on. Things are never solved. There's always another match. There's always another angle, etc. Same thing with the news media. You turn it on, Democrats and Republicans will never get along. They can never get along. It's an endless power struggle. Well, that's simply just not true. Other countries, and even us here in the past, our parties have found a way to work on certain policy issues and certain legislation and try and mitigate differences where they exist. You have to have it that way for a democracy. We can't function when 330 million people split into camps of two and never communicate, never agree, or never work together.
It's interesting. It brings to mind, I was talking to someone yesterday because that big news story came out about Barry Weiss quitting at the New York Times. And I was telling them, I don't really like Barry Weiss much. I think she targeted academics for their pro-Palestinian views. And they said, well, since when are you a Trump supporter? And I just looked at them and I said, what? I don't understand. What's the connection between my not liking Barry Weiss very much and being a Trump supporter? He said, well, she's a liberal. She doesn't like Trump. And I said, well, I can dislike Trump and also have major disagreements with Barry Weiss. And they could not comprehend that. They said, I don't understand. It was kind of shocking to me. It was jarring.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect analogy of what I'm talking about. I mean, I encounter those same issues all the time. Like if I'm critical of the Democratic Party, which I'm proud to say I've been critical of both parties ever since I was able to start thinking. You know, if I'm critical of the Democratic Party in the Trump age, I'm like a secret, you know, Trump supporter or something like that. But yeah, it's not conducive to effective discourse. Like, I think it'd be a lot more constructive if you had said you didn't like Barry Weiss for someone to say, really, why? And then have you present your evidence, and then maybe they have counter evidence, and then you guys could decide. Maybe you'll change your mind, or maybe they'll change their mind, or maybe you'll agree to disagree, but at least you'll know where each other stand. But this instant like knee-jerk reaction to label you a Trump supporter and kind of toss you out, that's not helping anybody.
So in regards to what we can do to sort of foster a better free press that, you know, really aids in strengthening democracy, I guess we have to get into the functions of the press because, you know, it's funny. People will say to me, oh, you believe in that fourth estate. And that seems like an outdated concept because now, you know, money's the bottom line and that's just sort of the way it is. And I'm like, no, that we can't think that way. That's awful. At least to me. But I guess in that regard, what do you think the functions of the press are? Because obviously you and I believe that the press should be about more than just, getting, you know, ratings.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, where I would start that conversation is to say, you know, to ask someone like, you know, do you want to live in a democracy? And maybe some people don't, and that's fine. But let's start there. Because if you want to live in a democracy, then we can talk about how we can get and maintain a democracy. And the press is a very important part of that. We as voters in a democracy are asked to make crucial decisions on everything from foreign policy to economic policy to race relations to gender equity and et cetera, et cetera. There's just simply not enough time, nor do I have the physical abilities to go everywhere, to research everything, to see everything. I need journalists in between to report these stories to me, to bring this information to me, so I can make the best informed vote, the best informed decision to protest, the best informed letter writing campaign, et cetera, I can. So you need the press to do those things. So the press, you know, it's number one thing. It's an information disseminator. It gives us the information from the ground. With that comes great responsibility. The press is also the agenda setter. That is to say that they're going to decide, based on all the reporting they have, what is the most important, what's going to get the most attention or the first attention, et cetera, et cetera. So that's great responsibility that they have in that. They're also the great, you know, communicator as well between the public. We can use the press to get in the ear of those in power, and those in power can use the press to get in the ears of the voter and things like that. So they play a very crucial role, but you'll notice I keep saying in their responsibility, you don't just get that responsibility because you call yourself the press. It comes with a long history of setting up a relationship with news users where they trust you. Unfortunately, a lot of our press outlets, and I said at the beginning of the show, we have six corporations that control 90% of our media. A lot of those press outlets, because they've been seeking profit, have given up that credibility in many cases. And now they find themselves in an uncomfortable place in the Trump era. They badly want to be seen as the resistance to Trump's lies. And let's not sugarcoat it. Trump lies constantly. And the press is trying to position itself as the resistance to Trump's lies, but they don't have the credibility. They have a long history of lying themselves. And we need to build up their credibility. So what I argue is, and this is something the average news user can do, rather than consuming sort of news, think about how you want to use news. And by doing that, that means asking questions about what news can you use. And you'll find quite quickly, a lot of like the 24-hour news networks, a lot of the corporate media, you can't use that stuff. It's irrelevant. The real journalists, you know, are the ones who are on the ground. They're doing constant reporting. They're changing topics so they don't become so ensconced in the topic that they end up becoming a part of the problem. So I think that there is good journalism out there that I hope would take that away from my book. But I think it's not in a lot of the places that people sort of look for it in terms of like corporate media and things like that.
In regards to how we got here, I have to ask about this because I know you mentioned it, I think in chapter two, very briefly, but I feel like it's an important piece to this puzzle. How we got here, I always tell people, when we got rid of the fairness doctrine, that was a horrible, horrible mistake. And if you could, what was the fairness doctrine and what does it say about how we got here? Because I feel like it does play a role in bolstering this sort of fake news predicament.
Yeah, the fairness doctrine, you know, it didn't directly go after fake news, and it wouldn't solve the problem, but it would definitely mitigate a lot of our problems. The fairness doctrine came out of the 1940s, and it was a policy by the federal government that said, look, if you have a certain view on your show, or you attack a certain view on your show, or news, or publication or whatever, you have to give equal time to the opposite view. That way the news user gets a balanced view or somewhat balanced view of the news. So you can't create these little silos where you just perpetuate BS and you practice confirmation bias. You have to get other views in there. And this forced it through federal law. Well, they stopped enforcing it in the late 70s and 80s, and basically it's officially abolished.
And I was going to say, is that in part because of, you know, Watergate happens, the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, there's this sort of declining faith in everything after these events.
Yeah, it's spot on. But the irony of all that, right, is that it's the press is the one who exposed what was wrong with all of these organizations. It started with the independent press, then it was picked up by the corporate press about Watergate and the lies in Vietnam and all that. The public, as you pointed out, turned against all institutions, including the press. And that's how we had sort of the rise of conservatism, which rejected government intervention in the market, government intervention in culture and society. It rejected institutions like the press. So the Fairness Doctrine, you know, it gets, you know, stopping in force completely in 1987. That's the same year Rush Limbaugh comes out.
And it basically made it so that, so for instance, if you had a communist or if you had a Nazi on, you'd have to have a communist on to give their side and, you know, yada, yada.
Right, right. Basically, yeah. If you had like, if you had a Nazi on a program, you'd, you know, be expected to have like an anti-fascist on or something like that for an equal amount of time. But now, yeah, since the late 80s, you can just create media silos and say what you want. You don't have to have other views on. This was the genius of Fox. Fox, they have, if you look at all of Fox's taglines, every single one of them talks about being fair and balanced. We report, you decide. So they give this sort of veneer of a balanced news channel, but it's conservative talking heads, you know, beating you over the head with conservative talking points 24 hours a day. And they can get away with it because there's nothing legally binding that says they have to have alternative views or other views on their programming.
It's interesting, too, because I think, and you cover this in the book as well, but I think there's this issue with people not being able to differentiate between news and, for instance, well, like when you watch someone like Sean Hannity, he's not a reporter in the same sense as Woodward and Bernstein reporting on Watergate. He's an opinion editorialist, right? And there's people that can't make that distinction anymore. There's people that have trouble distinguishing between an advertisement and a news story. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Real journalists aren't in a news studio preparing for a show all day. Real journalists are out talking to people. They're vetting sources. They're getting information. And good stories usually take quite a long time to report. These people in the studio, they're talking heads. They're sometimes pulling stuff from real journalists and then talking about it on their shows. But increasingly, especially at Fox, my God, they're using the internet. They're pulling things from like Drudge and InfoWars and putting them on the air without vetting these stories and using them as talking points to create this kind of like feedback loop. So if you go on the internet, you read this story and you're like, oh, it's kind of weird. And then you turn on Fox and then like Fox is saying it. And then the president's Twitter account is tweeting about it. And then Fox is talking about the tweet. And you're like, oh, wow, this must be real. Everyone's talking about this. That's kind of the perception that comes from it. But, yeah, back to my point earlier, I mean, like people like, Bill O'Reilly and folks, they were TV personalities. They're not journalists. They know how to look at a camera. They know how to sell something. They know like about lighting, things like that, but they don't necessarily know about the, issues in which they talk about with such authority. And that's why it's dangerous at a certain level. I do want to, kind of be speaking of Fairness Doctrine, I want to be balanced myself and saying that I can't just blame conservatives and Fox News for this issue. Liberals, especially young liberals, got really comfortable in the early 2000s with The Daily Show, which if you go back and read like academic studies in early 2000s, fake news meant satire comedy, like Daily Show. That's what fake news would be in reference to back then.
I was going to comment on that real quick because the next thing I was going to ask you about was satirical news and fake news.
Yeah. Yeah. Good segue. So basically Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, originally they were just kind of a funny show that was going to like lampoon news headlines. But Stewart finally found a formula that worked, which is he, like everyone else, knew that Fox and the other 24-hour news networks were basically just perpetuating partisan BS. So he started lampooning them and exposing their BS, which, you know, it feels good to watch The Daily Show. It was funny to watch him, you know, go after these people who talk with such authority. But really all he was doing was kind of adding more cynicism to the left, which is the left became kind of this comedic character that could mock conservatives, while conservatives on Fox became this conservative character that would be mocking liberals in the mainstream. And nowhere in there is news. There's no journalism in the process of any of that. So that's kind of the role.
Add something to that really quickly?
Absolutely.
I was going to say, I mean, I really loved Jon Stewart in my teenagers, right? My teenage years. And, you know, I always remember that episode of Crosstalk Crossfire that he was on. And, you know, he did sort of want to have it both ways, right? Because he was saying, well, I'm not a journalist. I'm an entertainer. But I think it was Tucker Carlson that was saying to him, but you're trying to be like a journalist. You're trying to be a critic of the media. And, you know, of course, Jon Stewart said, well, you're the one working at CNN. I'm just working for Comedy Central. It's not my issue. But, you know, as much as I like Jon Stewart, he did sort of want to have it both ways, where he wanted to be sort of respected, but also be able to say, oh, I'm just a comedian. And it did blur the lines a lot.
I completely agree. I think of there was that incident on Crossfire, which is very famous. And then the Jim Cramer interview. When he interviewed Jim Cramer on Daily Show, that was the first time I ever wrote a letter to a celebrity. I wrote Jon Stewart a letter, and I said, you know, man, I think you've really crossed the line from comedian to now, you know, kind of being like the mainstream vanguard of this economic populism, because nobody else in the mainstream was really kind of talking about it at that time. But you're right. He wanted it both ways. He didn't want to position himself as that. But then like two or three years later, he did with Colbert, the guy, what's it called? The Rally to Restore Sanity, where they were going to go out and try and do this big political movement to get independent voters to kind of search for truth rather than fall into the partisan trap. So I agree. I think there were these big issues where you could see Jon Stewart wanted to step out of the comedy role, but as soon as he did, he got sort of terrified and wanted to reestablish himself as the quote unquote comedian. But in the process, nonetheless, it blurred the lines and
it gave us Red Eye at Fox News with Greg Gutfeld.
Yeah, Red Eye gave its own version of this conservative comedians mocking like liberal mainstream culture and things like that. So in nowhere in there, I mean, you can, like you said, you grew up watching Jon Stewart. I grew up watching Jon Stewart. I found Daily Show highly entertaining. But a lot of folks, young folks at that time, would cite Jon Stewart as their number one source for news. And he was not a journalist. And in most cases, there was no real journalism on his program. So we're back to that same problem we had with 24-hour news networks, which is there's no real journalism in the content you're using.
Well, it continues now. I mean, doesn't it? I mean, I know you mentioned in the book Samantha Bee's Full Frontal, and there, you know, Trevor Noah is still doing The Daily Show. And the one I always see a lot of young people are really into is John Oliver's Last Week Tonight. And I mean, I think it's an interesting show, and I like it too, because he does point out BS. But, you know, when you blur these lines between entertainment and fact, it's going to have ramifications. And I like that your book is one of the few that has sort of pointed out that, you know, this is creating blowback in a way.
Yeah, there's, you know, yeah, Oliver's just another case. I mean, all these people are trying to put a entertaining spin on breaking down what's in the quote unquote news. But they're relying on that same like 24-hour news sources. They're, you know, selective in the stuff they choose. And look, I like John Oliver. I like his show. But again, he's not an expert on these topics.
Well, it's as you put it, one of the subheadings in your book is privileging entertainment over facts. You know, I'm sure John Oliver cares about facts, but he wants to do an entertaining show. I mean, that does create a little bit of a conflict there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there, you know, some people that had successful models, like, it's not the best, because I think he does too much all at once and has odd guests. But like, you know, Bill Maher has tried to get experts to sit in with entertainers to talk about like actual topics. So there are, you know, there are some like venues that and John Oliver's show, I put in this well, there are venues that show promise of having constructive discourse, but again, none of it's a replacement for actual journalism. You need someone talking to sources. And just so I can make this clear to like your audience here, what I'm getting at is that in addition to cutting regulation, these six corporations that control 90% of media to maximize profits, they've cut journalism. So they cut overseas bureaus, they cut anybody who's in a small market. So if you're not like in like Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Atlanta. If you're not in there, they pretty much got rid of all the journalists outside of those big markets. And then they usually don't report on weekends, if you notice. Something big happens on a Saturday or Sunday. They don't have a lot of journalists out there. So it's a handful of journalists in a handful of markets, generally covering a handful of topics that the corporate press will publish or comment upon. There's so much more stories and information that are out there that we're missing, that we need, that we're not getting. And we're filling that time with this sensationalistic partisan arguing or lampooning of ideological enemies and things like that, which again, are just not helping the average voter.
Before we start closing out, something I guess we have to talk about is a concept that Mickey always brings up whenever I have him on. He has to emphasize critical media literacy, critical media literacy. And I don't think enough people hear that term. So maybe you can lay it out for us. What is critical media literacy and how do we achieve it?
See, those of us who study media, we learn our own branding exercises. So good work, Mickey. The distinction is for this purpose. So media literacy has been around for about 100 years. Unfortunately, in the United States, those who advocate for media literacy, a lot of them tend to be taking funds from corporations or working with corporations who see media literacy as a vehicle to get their content in the classroom, to get people used to their tools, dependent upon their tools, or even worse, data collection, right? They if they get in the classroom, they can collect all the data from all the students. That's why a lot of these companies are very happy that we're teaching online due to the pandemic. Critical media literacy, it adds a different dynamic, a different component. We think that when we study media, we should look at the power dynamics behind media and that are expressed by media. And this means who owns it, who controls it, for what purpose, how are different groups represented or not represented, how are the power dynamics of things like race and gender and class and sexuality expressed in media, solidified in media, etc. So that's the critical media approach we think is much more important because it empowers the media user. We're not afraid of media. We don't ask people to stop using media. We just want to give people as much information and context for the media they're using as they use it, and let the user decide. So that's kind of the big distinction. Now, we get a lot of pushback because those who do take corporate funding and, of course, corporations, they argue that by discussing things like race, class, gender, and economics, we're somehow being biased. But them treating their content as like the normal objective baseline and...
Isn't there not talking about it a bias, though?
That's what I was just going to say. That's their trick they use is by not talking about it, they think they're being objective, but... in reality, that in itself is an ideology that we should disregard those issues. Is it in its own way an ideology?
You know, that sort of brings me back to what I was trying to say about Brexit and about the rise of Trumpism. I feel like if a lot of voters didn't have all the facts, and a lot of voters, I feel like, were misled, because I remember when the 2016 election happened, I was hearing a lot of just false things being said about Hillary Clinton, who I'm not a fan of, but there were, I think, overwrought things said on the Republican sort of right-wing noise machine side of things. And I think there were things said about Trump that were untrue, or he was saying things that were untrue, and people couldn't tell the difference. And I kind of think that if the media isn't able to get all the facts out there, then you can't have a functioning democracy. In a way, I have trouble blaming the citizens. Sometimes I get more aggravated with the media ecosystem not living up to its expectations as the fourth estate.
The studies are out there as well that during the every presidential election for the last 40 years, policy has got less and less time on like the nightly news broadcasts, which are the most watched news, as compared to things like, Hillary's emails or Trump's speeches, which get tons of coverage disproportionately to something like healthcare, which gets like, a couple minutes but is way more important to people's lives. So I think you're spot on that it's fun to blame like the voters, but in reality, the voters are only as good as the information they have. And if the information they have is junk, then you can expect junk reactions, which is what we, you know, sort of received. I had an interesting experience though in 2016. I was doing research on all these different colleges across the United States, and I decided to drive it because I wanted to see a lot of the country I'd not seen before. And me and my wife, we drove through, you know, like Ohio and Michigan, Florida, and all this. And we saw the Trump signs everywhere, and to us, we kind of thought like, wow, it's so weird that these signs are everywhere. Don't they know that like nobody supports this guy? But it was our own way of kind of buying into like the media narrative, right? That no one supported Trump, but it was right in front of our eyes. We can distinctly remember driving through, and there's Trump signs everywhere. And I think that's a great analogy for kind of how the media operates. It's so distant from most of the country that it kind of just talks in its own bubble in its own world. And why the election of Trump scared them so much, I think, was that they didn't see it coming at all. For them, they thought, oh, the Obama economy was great. Neoliberalism is working. You know, we're going to get 4 more years of this with Hillary Clinton. She's been a great ally of the neoliberals. And out of nowhere, they found this just like angry base that was willing to try this guy who had no governing experience and was a reality television star to be president.
I was going to say in that regard, I always use the example of Rachel Maddow, who seems like a very educated person, right? I mean, she was a Rhodes Scholar, but that also has the effect of, you know, I don't know that Rachel Maddow as a Rhodes Scholar is always in touch with the people I live around in Pennsylvania or in Florida.
Yeah, there's definitely a disconnect there for sure. And I think that, you know, this gets back to what I was saying about real journalists are not in studios. Real journalists are out talking to people. They try and get an understanding of what's going on in the public sphere. If you're in a studio the entire time talking to other elites, you're not really going to get a feel for what's going on in the United States of America. And I think this will be a question that historians will grapple with forever, but it was, did people vote for Donald Trump or did they vote against Hillary Clinton? And then that's going to be, I think, kind of an age-old question that we really haven't come to grips with yet. And, you know, I don't necessarily know exactly where I stand on that because there's evidence both ways. But it does seem to be that the rejection of elites was a major theme running through 2016, not just here in the U.S., but in Britain and other places.
Now, I always like to end on a positive note. I don't know if this will be a positive note, but I wanted to get your personal experiences with regards to talking to younger people about the idea of critical media literacy and what you've seen in younger people. Are they able to sort of tell the difference between, you know, an advertisement and posing as a news article and a news article? Are there problems with that? Are there kids that get it?
Yeah, you know, I teach critical media literacy and I teach this stuff and, you know, maybe this is my own bubble, but in the classroom, it makes you really optimistic about the future because when you put this information in front of people and you kind of let them decide, I can't tell you how many emails I get back from people, you know, students, former students who say, God, you know, after your class, I got rid of Facebook. It was just like a time suck. I didn't need it. Or, you know, after your class, man, I only read, you know, these like news, these journalists or whatever. And I feel a lot better now. Or before I was used to be this side of the aisle. Now I'm this side of the aisle or whatever. You hear them, you know, they report back to me thinking out loud and exploring like themselves and really caring about truth and democracy in a way they hadn't before. So, you know, as I advocate in the book, and I think this is true for any educator, and you don't have to be a professional educator or like at a school, you can be a parent, you can be a friend. If you take the time to put this information in front of people and you treat people with the dignity and respect that they deserve, and you have humility about your own shortcomings, I think there's a lot of progress that can be made for a democracy and in terms of sifting through fake news and finding legitimate journalism.
I was going to say in that regard too, it's very much a skill that needs to be learned, right? This idea of critical media literacy. It's not something you just, you know, have in you overnight. And I think people have to sort of keep that in mind. And I think a big solution to a lot of the problems that we see with regards to fake news is pretty simple. I mean, start teaching critical media literacy, even in, you know, public education.
Yeah, there's a, I mean, there's been a push for this for a long time. Unfortunately, you know, corporations are trying to hijack the process. There's a lot of us out there, you know, like there's Dr. Allison Butler, who's at University of Massachusetts Amherst. There's Jeff Scher, who's down at UCLA, and Noah Golden and some other folks, Robin Anderson and Fordham University. They're doing this work, you know, like Mickey Huff and Project Censor are doing, but they're all nonprofits and they don't have Facebook money. So they're doing it because it's a labor of love. You know, like Allison Trope down at USC, she has a great program with teachers called the Critical Media Project with parents and teachers. So these folks are trying to do this work, but the money's not there. But the public interest is. So I think, you know, like I said, reaching out, sort of having these discussions, and teaching people basic skills. Like I always said, just ask questions. Like don't accept whatever is put in front of you. Just ask questions. Like what is the evidence behind it? What's the motive behind it? How does this make me feel? Do I want it to be real because it confirms my view, but is it real? You know, like I think those can be like just powerful steps the average person can take.
When you say Facebook money, by the way, I should have mentioned this earlier. I guess you're referring probably to things like the Atlantic Council, where we there's sort of this idea going around that we can rely on the Silicon Valley and the tech crowd to solve all these issues, when really in a lot of ways they may have helped create these issues.
Yeah, I completely agree. I outlined in that in the book that you know, Silicon Valley is responsible for a lot of the latest problems with fake news. They really exploited this problem and made it worse. And, you know, despite living close to Silicon Valley, I'm not in the techno-utopian camp. I don't think we can technologically innovate our way out of this problem. In fact, I think a lot of times the tech solutions have made the problems worse. And, the Facebook money, I mean, Facebook gives money out to educators and organizations under the auspices of furthering media literacy. And it's great PR. I mean, they look great doing it. But in reality, what they're doing is they give that money so they can get into the classroom to collect more data. So they're buying data in these PR stunts and things like that. I'm not a big believer in the tech solutions. And I painstakingly take some time in the book to go through the different tech solutions and point out why they're not working or problematic or even make things worse. Because I think it's crucial that people recognize that even though right now it kind of seems like Silicon Valley is against Trump and there's this war between the two sides, Trump spent $100 million on Facebook and he got people from Facebook to show his team how to use the tools in 2016. And he's been having meetings with Mark Zuckerberg over the last year.
Peter Thiel was a big fan too of Donald Trump, Mr. Yeah. Palantir himself.
There you go, dude. Yeah, another major funder from Silicon Valley behind Trump. So yeah, this notion that Silicon Valley is at war with Trump is just simply false. And I tried in the book to get people to look a little deeper at that.
Well, hey, Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This was a really cool conversation. Hopefully we'll get to a chat again soon.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education. Please check out the book, check out Project Censored, and of course, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And if you can, please support me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. Shoutouts, producer credits, I should say, to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Gary, and Brace for keeping this show going. If you haven't yet, please consider joining them in the $10 tier on Patreon for a producer's credit and other fun benefits. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.